Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review. I'm Tom Edwards. We're kickstarting the week in London's art galleries. Later on in the show, we'll head to China too. But keeping to the capital, for now, I'm joined by the art newspaper's editor-at-large, Jane Morris. Jane, welcome to the show. Good to have you with us, as ever. Let's start, shall we, at Tate Modern for a show that's been making headlines this week. The Radical Eye, an exhibition of modernist photography from the music legend Elton John's personal collection. And quite some collection it is. This isn't just photos by big artists, but also photos of big artists. What's on show, Jane, on camera and off? It's impressive, isn't it?
It's actually quite an amazing collection. Apparently, he's got 8,000 photographs. There's about 200, I think, on show here, and they're focusing on the 20s to the 50s, which I suppose is a sort of golden age of photography. Although I think his collection is wider. I mean, it clearly comes, you know, forward, and I may even go back a bit further. But anyway, 20s to the 50s, and it's an absolutely classic museum quality collection, which I think is the big surprise about it. I mean, he's either educated himself greatly or had very good advice, probably both. And, you know, the Tate only started collecting photography in 2009, so it hasn't got any of this work, or very little of it, and most of it now is unaffordable. Elton John apparently started collecting in 1990 when he gave up drinking, and although prices then were still quite high for some of these artists, they're nothing like, you know, where they are now. I mean, now you're talking millions of dollars. So he's built up this extraordinary collection, and it's a really wonderful show.
Why now then? I mean, clearly, as you suggested, I mean, the Tate don't have access to this sort of depth and this kind of, to put this kind of work on display. So it kind of makes sense from their point of view. Do we know what's brought us to this point at this time?
No, in truth. I am guessing that it's obviously been well known that he has this collection. It's been known in the market and amongst curators for some time. I'm imagining that he's starting to think about his legacy and what he's going to do with it in future. And I think that, in combination with the fact that the Tate has, as I say, made this commitment to photography, some would say late in the day, but, you know, lots of other people haven't got photography curators still. So I'm guessing it's a combination of the fact that they have said, I mean, they've said for a while that they really want to focus on Eastern Europe and they'd love to focus on this period but can't buy it. So I think it's probably just one of those serendipitous things that somehow the two have met. And maybe this is the beginning of a romance that might end up...
A beautiful relationship.
That might end up with a donation, who knows?
Who can say? Let's talk about Elton John a little bit more specifically, because it's always interesting, I think, when you see works, particularly, and it's unusual to see such, as you said, a museum-quality collection all from one person in one place. It's not been without criticism. Some people have made some remarks about the frames on certain works, which is quite interesting. I mean, obviously, we should just look at the work on its own merit, but it's also interesting to get a bit of a glimpse, maybe, into Elton's collecting head, and I don't know, even Elton's house. I mean, is that where this work's come from? Do we know?
Yeah, there's actually a short film inside, and it shows him in his house in Atlanta. And I am not joking. I think he said that it's something like 18,000 square feet, this apartment. And he said...
Is that an apartment?
Yeah. He said, though, that he only did it to fit the art in. Like, he went, you know, me and David don't need all this space, but we need it for the art. I am not joking. It's like something out of the 18th century. The walls are filled top to bottom, every single room. His taste is obviously, I mean, in his kind of decorating taste, is clearly in that rather... I don't know how you'd put it, kind of American take on slightly more historical look, if you know what I mean. So there's a lot of these heavy gold frames and heavy silver painted frames. I think you stop noticing them quite quickly. But in fairness, when you do first walk in, you do think, wow, you never see frames like that in a museum ever.
That's a first for the Tate. And what about the actual work then? I mean, you've spoken about this already a little bit. You know, we're talking about great names in the sort of, you know, modernist photographic movement. And you said this is kind of a golden age. These days, everyone's a photographer, aren't they? Does this remind you what great photography really is?
Well, of course, it's nearly all black and white. I mean, the couple of things that are not black and white are actually photo montage, so they're not colour photography. It starts with the earliest piece is André Kertész's Underwater Swimmer. He's a Hungarian photographer, and this piece was made in 1917. It's really, really tiny because it's the contact print. It's incredibly rare and valuable. So it kind of starts with people like him and Laszlo Moholy-Nagy, and then we move through you know, the kind of classic Americans. But in between, we've got sort of people like Dora Maar and Imogen Cunningham. There's actually quite a lot of women in it. Imogen Cunningham, Tina Modotti, and then the people you would expect, Edward Weston, Edward Steichen, Dorothea Lange's very famous, you know, migrant mother. So they're black and white. I mean, there's so many different photo processes, as I'm sure you're aware. So you can get some sense of that looking at these. They are mostly, in fact, they are all vintage prints, which means they were all made at the time by the photographer, which again is very rare. Mixing is very valuable. They're very, the surfaces on them are absolutely beautiful. And it does make you think, though, about the technical demands of what people were trying to do. Because we also have some real modernists in here who are playing around with distorting things, and I say photomontage, double printing. They're very, very beautiful. Although, as I say, it's not a totally comprehensive collection. He obviously doesn't collect much in the way of landscape. Well, don't say obviously, but if you see the show, you will see, obviously, he doesn't have. So, you know, he doesn't have Edward Steichen's landscapes. He doesn't have Gustave Le Gray's. I mean, maybe he has them in his collection. They're not on show here because obviously we don't know the whole thing. But I think there's quite a big emphasis on portraits and the nude. And, you know, he obviously likes pictures of celebrities. So, as you say, we've got lots of artists on artists. You know, famously, Stieglitz photographing Georgia O'Keeffe, you know, Man Ray photographing Picasso. There's a lot of them all photographing each other. And then the nudes, I mean, they are really, really beautiful. And they mostly come from the 30s. But they're full of that kind of beautiful, stagey, you know, the bodies are absolutely gorgeous. So I think you get a sense that that's probably Elton John's taste, which would make sense, I think.
It would indeed. It's certainly a collection that's caught people's imaginations, and it's well worth checking out. The Radical Eye, modernist photography from the Sir Elton John collection, is on until the 7th of May. Let's head next, Jane, shall we, to Parasol Unit in North London, where an exhibition by American sculptor and draftsman Robert Therrien is on show. This show, Jane, brings us to a slightly more modern period than the last. Works from the mid-70s to the mid-90s. For the uninitiated, who is Robert Therrien? How would you sort of introduce him to our listeners if they're not familiar?
Okay, he was born in Chicago, I think. He's in his late 60s. I think he's 69. But he's actually worked in California most of his career. He's well known among the American museum circuit. So people like Eli Broad has got a substantial collection of him. Most of the big museums have got significant chunks of his work, whether we're talking about MoMA or the Los Angeles County Museum, San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. So very well known in America, much less well known here. Although, if you remember, I think it was about 7 years ago, 2009, I think, the Tate had these huge tables and chairs. I don't know if you remember them. The chairs were so big you could walk underneath them. That's one of his later pieces. And Anthony Doffé, who's famously collected these sets of artist rooms, that has collected a Robert Therrien room. So he's well known, as I say, in the history of American sculpture, but obviously more in America than here. This set of work is all, I mean, the core of it is, yes, 70s, 80s, 90s. So it's mostly when he's at the younger end of his career, not as a total beginner, because he started off with found objects. And this is the period where he's in his late 20s, 30s for most of the works in this show. And this is the period where he's sort of experimenting between abstract and not abstract, if that makes sense. So, I mean, if I give you one example, there's a piece which is a set of stainless steel silver balls. They very obviously relate to American minimalist sculpture. So if you think of somebody classic like Donald Judd with the steel cubes. So these are kind of a set of steel balls, but it doesn't half look like a snowman. And that's deliberate. All the way through this show, there's these little playings with things, I think, from his childhood memory. Mm. So there are shapes that could be abstract but look like Dutch churches. As I say, the snowman, things that look like the roof of barns. He kind of reminds me a bit about Robert Gober, if people know Robert Gober's work, except Robert Gober's work, everything there is kind of a bit dark, and there's always this kind of undertow of sexual darkness, racial darkness, those kind of issues. Whereas Robert Therrien is somehow much lighter and much kind of happier.
Well, it seems there's almost a kind of quite a charming naivety almost to it. And you said this sort of almost a childlike, a wonder almost at the world. And certainly the sort of snowman piece is one that would do that. Is this an exhibition that that sparks the imagination? Does it tap in, do you think, to the visitor's own sense of childlike wonderment almost?
Well, I think what's clever about it is because he's both, if you know what I mean. There's something familiar and unfamiliar, you know, about it. There's something childlike and apparently simple. But when you start really thinking about them and thinking about how they work in this kind of symbolic way, and you could actually read them as abstract, certainly some of them you could definitely read as abstract, you start to realise they're more complicated. But it's a very peaceful and rather uplifting and rather thought-provoking show, but it really doesn't scream at you. I mean, some of it's funny. There's a piece where he's taken they're like reliefs coming out of the wall. So three circular reliefs, they're painted brown. He's stuck some taps on them. And, you know, initially it looks like a totally abstract sculpture. Then you notice the taps and then you realise it's a cloud. And it's kind of funny because you could, in your imagination, turn the taps on and off. But walk a bit further back and it looks like a rather classic American piece of minimalism. So I think it's rather fun. When I went, there's only been me in the gallery, really. I think most people don't know him. So if you want to go and see some really interesting sculpture and see it in peace and quiet, this is a good opportunity. I mean, he's an interesting guy, I think.
Peace and quiet and a little levity as well. In the current international climate.
It's what we need, isn't it?
That sounds like the perfect way to while away an afternoon. Robert Therrien works 1975 to 1995, is on at Parasol Unit until the 11th of December. And that brings us to the end of this London part of today's show. So Jane Morris, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Now we're going to spin the globe and land in China, or more specifically Shanghai, to meet one of the country's leading contemporary artists, Gu Wenda. Gu Wenda is a rarity in the Chinese art world, an artist with a social message who steers clear of political controversy and counts some of China's biggest corporations as his benefactors. For a later show at the Mingcheng Museum in Shanghai, the main spectacle is the 25,000 Chinese lanterns he's hanging from the building. Not a provocative act per se, but certainly one guaranteed to gain attention. Gu recently sat down with Monocle's Shanghai correspondent Justin Bergman to discuss contemporary Chinese art and why corporate sponsorship in the art world may not be such a bad thing.
My first work I did actually in a few years ago in Brussels. It was 6,000 lanterns to cover the meeting hall of the first World Expo after the Second World War. And it was a success. It stayed for about 4 months. It's kind of the first time to display lantern that way in a contemporary, you know, approach.
You've talked a little bit in previous interviews about how young Chinese artists these days aren't so interested in doing art that's critical of society or problems, pushing barriers, things like that. I wanted to ask about that. What do you think the reason is?
I'm belong in the 85 movement. So usually my generation more critical art creation, more related to social, political and cultural issues. But the young artists is much less. They're more focused on the financial achievement.
The commercial side.
Yeah.
And also, big change in China recently has been financing of exhibitions and financing of shows and museums. Big corporations now involved in financing. Is this a positive step for the art world in China?
Yeah, in a certain aspects, actually, it's kind of good for good move for the art establishment. But as everybody knows, China art patronage, art system, or government support still not yet completed, and it's still in the first stage. You know, it's still in a kind of a primitive, you know, approach. I talk about art history. You know, in Renaissance, the Pope, the Church is the patronage for Michelangelo, for Da Vinci. In the 18th century, I think the noble class, the royal family, is the patronage for like a Beethoven, for Mozart. Then today, I think in our era, in the future, instead of individual collectors or galleries or market, second market, I think corporation will play the big role for China art scene. Especially, you know, the corporation now, they building, you know, the developers, they have a certain government regulation, they have to produce certain cultural sectors in their development. I think that's good for artists, hopefully.
And for you, you've worked with some big corporations, patrons in the past. Are there any constraints with working with with corporations in terms of the programming or anything at all?
Every move, you go with the commercial gallery, you have maybe less cultural, political issue, but may you have a commercial restraint. But with the corporations, of course, subject matter, in many ways, you have to be more positive than the negative. The corporation not only presents the sponsorship of the money, also corporation connect to the society, people, and the government. So they're the kind of intermediary, you know, it's like an agent. So in a certain sense, you have to follow, it always have to have a wise negotiation.
Yeah, and another thing that's been changing in China recently is a lot of artists maybe not working with galleries like they used to in the past. You haven't really worked with a gallery.
I work
you have
myself.
Your own. Yeah.
Always myself. I never signed any contract, but I can work with a gallery with buy projects. Let's say whatever, you know, if it's good for the gallery, good for me. And also gallery can produce, you know, can also bring the collectors. What, you know, gallery basically is an art shop, right? So, and I work, but I need a freedom.
What do you like when you come back to China? What kind of feeling do you get here?
You know, I see China more layers than most of Chinese live here, because I have a comparison. You know, I live in America so long and live in different countries. So for me, it's the place I born. It has been changed. But comparatively speaking, and China has a lot of things to improve. Yeah, it's not ready in many sense.
That was Chinese contemporary artist Gu Wendar speaking to Monocle's Justin Bergman. And Gu Wendar's journey to the West is on until mid-February at the Mingxiang Art Museum in Shanghai. That brings us to the end of today's programme. This is the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. Thanks once again to Jane Morris. Thanks too to our producer, Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time tomorrow when Georgie Rogers will be in the studio to talk music. But for now, goodbye from me and thanks for listening.